de los peruanos.
This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. Hoy desde Perú estamos.
Today we're coming to you from Peru with Anay Durand, former Minister of Women and Vulnerable Populations of Peru, during the government of President Pedro Castillo.
Pedro Castillo. Ella es socióloga, catedrática.
She is a sociologist and a member of the faculty of San Marco. Dear Anay, welcome to Black and White.
Negro y blanco.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Anay. Todo el mundo caracterizamos.
We all consider Fujimori's government to be a genocidal, repressive government.
Un gobierno represor, un gobierno con características.
With the same characteristics as Vizcarra and Pinochet in Latin America, from an economic point of view.
En América Latina. ¿Cuál es la ideología?
What was the ideology and policy that the dictatorship of Alberto Fujimori took?
La dictadura de Alberto Fujimori.
Bueno, el gobierno Fujimori es electo por voto popular.
Well, I must say that the Fujimori government was elected by popular vote in 1990 in the context of a severe structural crisis in Peru, like an unprecedented hyperinflation, a very bloody internal armed conflict. In the meantime, Fujimori came to power with the promise of not restoring to shock and neoliberal measures. 2 years later, in 1992, he tries to establish special relations with a part of the armed forces and business groups, and he does this with the advice of Vladimiro Montesinos. And on April 5, 1992, he closes the Congress and declares a state of emergency. It is in this emergency situation that he starts to implement the neoliberal model in the country. In terms of ideology, we must say that Fujimorism does not have a great ideology and does not belong to any great discourse, but a completely pragmatic government that tried to create a shock. In addition, the vote itself in an authoritarian government allowed the implementation of neoliberal measures and the orders from Washington. These measures included the privatization and liquidation of state-owned companies, the national airlines such as Aeropro and Minropro, and all the companies that had been created in the previous decades within the framework of a developing country's business structure. In addition, policies were adopted in favor of multinational capitals, large capitals entered the mining sector, and various industrial sectors and pension funds. The implementation of this neoliberal structure reduced the state to its minimum size and, as we said, and obviously in a context of authoritarianism that allows arbitrary actions by the state. After these, the widespread corruption that you did not mention, something that is necessary as the characteristics of a genocidal government. This must be mentioned. Specifically in the Peru case, Fujimori was tried for corruption and mismanagement of public funds. So this is another feature of neoliberalism in Peru. There's a kind of mafia that takes advantage of the privatization of large capitals and steals the country's resources. On the other hand, another feature of Peruvian neoliberalism is the dissolution of social institutions. During this armed conflict, the leader of labor unions were killed. In this situation, the widespread division created a society without organization and without social organizations representing the people, and this reality helped neoliberalism continue its actions with much more ease. This is a summary of Fujimori's imposed economic policy. In 1993, Constitution passed the Fujimori regime. It establishes the policy, and this policy continued in the following years. In the post-Fujimori governments, elections were held in 2001, but absolutely nothing changed in relation to this economic regime. And moreover, the politics were deepened. After the increase in mineral prices, the elected governments after Fujimori deepened this neoliberal policy.
Perfecto, así es. Ahora, dime una cosa.
It is absolutely so. Now, tell me something. What is the explanation of Fujimori's freedom?
Del gobierno de la Dina Boluarte, que un gobierno que nadie la eligió.
In the first year of Dina Boluarte's government, a government that no one elected and came to power through a coup, what kind of disagreement and agreement is there that the Constitutional Court and the government body had even ignored international agreements in this field?
Inclusive de acuerdos internacionales que existen en esta materia.
Well, the amnesty of Alberto Fujimori is what his party has been seeking for years. We must note that in 2001, Fujimori left. But the problem was that the movement known as Popular Force was allowed to enter the political scene. The party led by Keiko Fujimori. When the government is not in their hands, they change the laws through Congress, which means that by obtaining a majority in Congress, they can have direct representation in the Constitutional Court. And since the past, the Constitutional Court is responsible for the interest of Fujimori. And beyond that, they're trying to form a coalition, like what we saw in 2021, where together with the extreme right parties and the persecution of the big media, they remove the legitimate and elected president and impose Dina Boluarte as the president. Dina Boluarte was brought to power by the parties that lost the elections, and in the face of the popular reaction, to maintain her position in power, she adopts the policy of killing. There are complaints about genocide. 80 Peruvians have been killed in about 13 months due to demonstrations to defend their vote. Her supporter is the Congress, and the majority forces of the Congress belong to Fujimorism, to that movement. She's a kind of borrower of Fujimorism. Her government and cabinet are made up of members of the party that lost the election, the far-right Fujimorism, and she was preparing the ground for this amnesty. Deputized Foreign Minister of Dina Boluarte, who was appointed a few months ago, is a known Fujimorist and was in favor of pardoning her. In addition, she's a serious critic of the Inter-American Court, which opposes Fujimori's amnesty. What has been done is to validate the amnesty that Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, former president of Peru, granted to Fujimori in 2017, which was found to be impractical and unconstitutional. And even the Inter-American Court said it was unenforceable. What this government is doing, as I said, a Fujimorism lone government, was to give credit to this amnesty. And for this, the Constitutional Court, whose members were elected by Fujimorism, came into action. Therefore, we are witnessing legal or seemingly legal clauses that can give a legal appearance to this amnesty, an amnesty that is illegal and illegitimate in all respects. Therefore, the political will and political discussion of Dina Boluarte has made this possible. And what we see at the end of the survival agreement, in which Dina Boluarte is dependent on Fujimorism, and Fujimorism has kept her in power because it does not want new elections to be held.
La mantiene porque no quiere que se abran nuevas elecciones.
We are in a disastrous draw. We take a short break and continue immediately.
Estamos de regreso en Negro y Blanco con Anaí Durán y
we're back with Black and White with Anaí Durán. Let's move on to the next question. Look, what is happening to the popular, democratic, and patriotic forces of Peru? Considering these conditions of ideological, political, economic, and repression unity that you mentioned in 80 years so far, new prisoners and the maximum limitation of public freedoms, In this situation, what happens to these forces and what is their reaction and capacity?
¿Qué reacción tienen? ¿Qué capacidad?
Bueno, lamentablemente, la crisis política...
Unfortunately, the political crisis in Peru is very deep, and there is no coherent political opposition forces. Dina Boluarte does not face opposition in Congress. Both right-wing and left-wing parties that are in Congress, such as Free Peru and other dissident parties, have about 4 to 5 seats. They have no opposition because they don't want to leave. The issue is that if Dina Boluarte resigns or is removed from office in Peru, new elections must be held and both Congress and the government must step aside and allow the electoral process to proceed. These congressmen and these political groups don't want that. And unfortunately, that's what deepens the crisis of representation, because what they're doing is self-preservation, and the citizens are vehemently against them. The performance of the Congress is faced with 96% dissatisfaction. And similarly, the dissatisfaction with the performance of the executive branch is 92%. We are in a crisis of representation and political crises in which citizens are not important for these groups, and they remain alive in this agreement as long as they can. So where is it left for the citizens? All that remains are the streets. Because of this, we have seen demonstrations. Demonstrations were held separately, and those who came to the streets were rural, noble communities, and those who voted for Pedro Castillo, for example, the Andean community, or workers in forest sector. Demonstrations related to poverty-stricken and damaged groups were brutally suppressed. Not only 80 people were killed, but 1,200 people were injured, 1,800 people were tried, and some of those demonstrators are still in prison. The dramatic situation that exists is due to the existence of an illegitimate government, which, by clashing with the coup plotters, has brought about the illegal and illegitimate removal of Pedro Castillo. And they do not want to allow the will of the people to decide their own fate. So what we're witnessing is the increasing decline of democracy. They are advancing in the Congress and in the government, and they are in the National Council of Justice, and they have made the judiciary opaque. They want to do the same with the National Electoral Council. So it seems that we cannot have an election contest in the short term. That is why the situation in Peru is very sad and very bad. We have to see if there are forces from more active classes during this year or the next year that can create synergies and play a role in politics.
Algún protagonismo político, ¿no?
Sí, y mira, eso... ¿Cómo lo ves tú? Porque el mundo...
What do you think about this? Because the whole world is changing. On the one hand, you see the clear decline of Western Europe and America, and the fall of American imperialism is clear, at least on the economic and political level. From a military point of view, it is still one of the first and perhaps the largest military powers in the world. It is clear that it is against many nations that are fighting for their freedom. But in Latin America, we see a tendency towards rightism and even extreme rightism of the terrorist type, with some of the characteristics of brutal dictatorships like Pinochet in Chile. For example, we have Milei in Argentina, Noboaro in Ecuador. Dina Boluarte is forming a dictatorship, and releasing Fujimori is a very clear signal about her direction. What's your idea?
De Fujimori dando una señal clarita, ¿cuál es su camino?
He was put there by the authoritarian and far-right coalition. A number of her main political supporters went to Milei's inauguration. Yes, I think she's part of this destructive phenomenon. But she herself? No. Dina Boluarte is not someone who does not have her own strength. She's been held by a coalition of coup plotters and mafia. Because I think that in Peruvian politics, the ability to form allegiances and exchange favors, negotiate and even exchange money to buy government institutions and remain in power is one of the necessities. Therefore, this coup coalition that ousted Castillo is a mafia, because it bought the institutions of the government. And it's this coalition that kept Dina Boluarte in the government and imposed the regime that is aligned with the extreme right sections that you mentioned. For example, Milei in Argentina and the issue of Ecuador. But she faces a very broad limitation, which is the lack of radical legitimacy. There is widespread opposition to her from the citizens, as well as the inadequacy of the regime, which has no success to show for it. And the security of the citizens is in a very disastrous situation. I think this is the worst citizen security crisis Peru has ever faced, especially in big cities like Lima and Trujillo. And I mentioned about the economy. The macroeconomics that Peruvian neoliberals were so proud of is in one of its worst conditions, if not the worst in a decade. So I think that in Latin America, the extreme right is taking advantage of the increasing problems that progressive governments are not solving. And in the case of Peru, as I mentioned, there is alignment, but there are certain conditions where the government has no legitimacy and no success to show.
De no tener legitimidad y además de no tener ningún éxito que mostrar, ¿no?
Pero de cualquier manera, siendo verdad eso, vivimos también un momento.
This is a fact, but in any case, we live in a time when it seems that democracy and public freedom and people's rights do not matter to the big and very big imperialist powers.
Pública y los derechos de la gente, no, porque estamos en un momento del látigo.
Well, we're coming to the end. Please give your closing remarks on this program and the vision you see for Peru today.
Y la perspectiva que tú ves hoy día sobre Perú.
Yes, in conclusion, I think that Peru's position in regional geopolitical equations should be strengthened. The American embassy was very active during the time of Pedro Castillo. I hope that in the future it will be clear that American Ambassador Lisa Kenna did a lot of things to set up the removal and coup against Castillo. I think that in this emerging multipolar world, Peru remains a bastion of American imperialism. In the end, I believe it is important to note that the international community's indifference to the events in Peru has been very high. Today, I take this opportunity to draw your attention to Peru. 1 year has passed since the beginning of the killings by the Dina Boluarte regime. In Juliaca, in Ayacucho, in the city of Juliaca, 18 people were shot dead by the police in just 1 day. In Ayacucho, 10 people were killed. And this issue was not condemned by anywhere, neither the Organization of American States nor the international community. We're still in a state of emergency, and our civil rights are still being curtailed. On the other hand, there is a call of solidarity from nations and some respectable governments. There are still governments, for example, Mexico, which behaved very respectfully, as well as Colombia and the countries of ALBA, to protest and condemn what is happening in Peru. We don't live in a normal democracy or anything like that. Therefore, the outlook is that this situation will intensify if there is no reaction to condemn these conditions and stand in solidarity with the Peruvian nation. And I use this opportunity to call for solidarity and draw attention. And I hope that you will be able to closely follow the developments that will take place in Peru in the coming months.
Así es, Anavi. Hay que,
That's right, Anai. Undoubtedly, we should consider this as a continental solidarity mission.
Porque la experiencia que vivió el pueblo peruano, ¿no? Con Fujimori.
Because the experience that the Peruvian nation had with Fujimori is being repeated with Dina Boluarte today.
Observamos aquello. Vemos nuevamente lo que pasó en 1992 en el fondo.
We are seeing it here in Chile. We must remember what happened in 1992. A legal appearance that is not legal.
Y como se llama, muy regado de represión.
Events intertwine with repression and politics that do not benefit the people and on the contrary, destroy rights, and at the international level, clearly align with American imperialism and notorious groups at the global level. This is what you have brought up. So I thank you for your presence, and I wish the best for the people of Peru. And I also demand the freedom of President Pedro Castillo.
Thank you. We will continue this fight. Thanks.
Keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the United States, former President Donald Trump confused Barack Obama for Joe Biden at a rally in Virginia on Saturday, 2nd of March, triggering further questions about the age of the likely Republican presidential nominee. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new poll by the New York Times and Siena College, a majority of voters in the United States believe Joe Biden is just too old to be an effective president. According to the poll's results, 73% of all registered voters believe Joe Biden is too old to be effective, in turn revealing spreading concerns about the 81-year-old president's mental competency. Among those who voted for Biden in 2020, 61% believe Biden's age will make him an ineffective president for a second term, with 26% indicating that they strongly agree and 35% indicating that they somewhat agree. The results of the wide-ranging poll, which were first released on Friday, 1st of March, are the latest blow to Joe Biden's election campaign, which has faced a barrage of criticism centered around Biden's age and widespread voters' fear about his ability to be president. At 81, Biden is the oldest president ever to seek re-election, though his likely challenger Donald Trump is only 4 years younger. However, in much recent polling, Joe Biden is usually trailing to Donald Trump, and he also faces high disapproval ratings. In response to whether Biden's age is such a problem that he's not capable of handling the job of president, 45% of total registered voters agreed in the latest New York Times Siena College study. Among those that voted for Biden 4 years ago, 19% said they agreed with the statement. Meanwhile, across all registered voters, 26% expressed that while Biden's age makes him ineffective, he's still able to handle the job of president well enough. Among those that voted for him in 2020, 41% agreed with the statement. In comparison to Joe Biden, 42% of all registered voters believe Donald Trump is just too old to be an effective president. Among those that voted for Trump in 2020, 5% indicated that they strongly agree, while 9% said they somewhat agree. Across all registered voters, 21% believe that the 77-year-old Donald Trump is ineffective, but he's still able to handle the job of president well enough, while only 19% said they believe Trump's age is such a problem that he's not capable of handling the job. The Business Insider has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump confused Barack Obama for Joe Biden at a rally in Virginia on Saturday, 2nd of March, triggering further questions about the age of the likely Republican presidential nominee who has made a string of such gaffes. It also comes at a time of similar concerns about Joe Biden. At 77 and 81 respectively, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are the oldest people to run for the presidency in American history. Trump on Saturday night, 2nd of March, in Richmond, Virginia, said, "Putin has so little respect for Obama that he's starting to throw around a nuclear word." You heard that, nuclear. He's starting to talk nuclear weapons today. The crowd reportedly went silent as Donald Trump referenced Barack Obama, who left office more than 7 years ago. It's the third time that Donald Trump has made the blunder in the past 6 months. The former U.S. president's other gaffes include confusing his Republican rival Nikki Haley with former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Nikki Haley, 52 years old, who has defied Trump and several primary defeats to continue in the race for the Republican nomination, has tried to frame herself as the younger, healthier option, referring to Donald Trump and Joe Biden as grumpy old men in her campaign advertisements. Trump's mistake came the day after Joe Biden twice confused Ukraine and Gaza as he announced that the U.S. would airdrop humanitarian supplies to Palestinians in Gaza who are dying of starvation due to the Israeli bombardment of the territory. Joe Biden said on Friday, 1st of March, "In the coming days, we're going to join with our friends in Jordan and others who are providing airdrops of additional food and supplies into Ukraine." He added that the United States will seek to open up other avenues into Ukraine, including possibly a marine corridor. A White House official later clarified that Joe Biden meant Gaza and not Ukraine. The gaffe had been changed in the transcript of his remarks. Questions about Biden's age have intensified in recent months. The latest lapse came just days after he was declared fit for duty at his annual health check. White House physician Dr. Kevin O'Connor said Joe Biden fully executes all of his responsibilities without any exemptions or accommodations. A New York Times Siena College opinion poll found that 73% of registered voters polled believed that Joe Biden is simply too old to be an effective president, including 61% of those who voted for him in 2020. Voters seem less bothered about Donald Trump, who is just 4 years younger, with 42% of those polled saying Trump is just too old to be an effective president. While criticisms of the age issue on both sides are laced with political spin, age-related cognitive decline is real. As a person gets older, changes occur in all parts of the body, including the brain. According to the National Institute on Aging, certain parts of the brain shrink, including those important to learning and other complex mental activities. Communication between neurons becomes less effective, and blood flow in the brain may decrease. Healthy, older adults can, however, learn new skills, form new memories, improve vocabulary and language skills. The National Institute on Aging is conducting research on so-called cognitive superagers, the minority of octogenarians and nanogenarians, whose memories are comparable to people 20 to 30 years younger.
النقي means the pure, the Immaculate, the Clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdaa al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaika.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety. This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Dialogue. I'm your host Mahdi. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام على أئمة الهدى ومصابيح التجا وأعلام التقى وذوي النهى.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala al-a'immati ad-du'ati.
Peace be upon the Imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority,
the left ones by Allah, his select, his party, the case of his knowledge, his argument, his path, his light, his proof. Allah's mercy and blessings to be upon them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about this very beautiful conversation that Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam has with one of his companions. And, of course, he's talking about compulsion and free will and how this is a matter which is between the two matters. It is neither absolute compulsion, neither is it absolute free will. Now, of course, it is recommended that the listeners go and check out the previous programs on this, because it is a very lengthy conversation, but there's various different points which are incredibly important. And of course, we are not able to talk about it in every single one of our sessions. Now, at one point, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, he talks about an individual who believes in absolute compulsion. And he says to the companion, who I believe is from Ahwaz, he says, whoever believes in compulsion, absolute compulsion, or what leads to absolute compulsion, considers Allah as being unjust and oppressive, especially if Allah punishes an individual whom Allah himself has forced into committing sin. So, of course, here we find that Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, he is setting the stage. He is setting the precursor here. Of course, nobody considers Allah to be unjust, and nobody considers Allah to be oppressive. And so here, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, he's trying to explain and say that, listen, if you believe in absolute compulsion, you believe that Allah is forcing people into committing sins, then Allah is unjust, God forbid, and he is oppressive. And then Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam says that whoever claims that Allah forces his people into their doings must also therefore say that Allah should not punish that individual. And whoever claims that Allah does not punish sinners denies Allah when he says in the Holy Quran that whoever earns evil and his sins beset him on every side, these are the inmates of the fire. And then Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, he talks about a couple of other verses of the Holy Quran, and he talks about how an individual who claims that Allah forces them into committing sins should therefore say that Allah cannot punish an individual for committing sins. But in the Holy Quran itself, it says that Allah will punish people for their sins because those people have willingly and have voluntarily committed sins. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en/call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
The U.S. Supreme Court could rule on Donald Trump's Colorado ballot eligibility just one day before the state's primary is set to open. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has covered this story and tells us more. The Supreme Court signaled it will issue rulings on Monday, 4th of March, an unusual declaration that indicates it may have made the decision already on the high-stakes question of whether Colorado may legally bar Donald Trump from appearing on the state's primary ballot. On its website, the Supreme Court said it will release an order list on Monday, 4th of March, the day before Colorado's state primary is set to take place alongside several other states, a primary season event known as Super Tuesday. The High Court said in a statement on its website that it may release opinions beginning at 10 a.m. on Monday, 4th of March, but won't take the bench. The court typically issues its rulings from the bench, and the unusual note could reflect the expedited timeline on which it heard Donald Trump's immunity case and the decision's extremely sensitive timetable. The Supreme Court justices are not scheduled to take the bench again until 15th of March. Donald Trump is currently set to appear on the Colorado ballot despite a ruling made by the state Supreme Court, which declared that Trump is ineligible to run in the race because his role in the January 6, 2021 Capitol riots amounted to an insurrection. The state ruling has been on hold while Donald Trump appealed it. The Supreme Court held oral arguments in early February in the case, which hinges on the assertion that Donald Trump is barred from running for office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, otherwise known as the Insurrection Clause. That provision was originally added to prevent ex-Confederates from holding U.S. office after the American Civil War on the grounds that they had broken their oath to the Constitution and acted against it. Donald Trump's lawyers have denied that he participated in any insurrection and have argued that the president doesn't constitute an officer of the United States, as written in the text. That defense didn't sway a panel of Washington, D.C. judges in a separate immunity case, while the Supreme Court has also agreed to hear. A ruling, if it lands on Monday, could determine Trump's eligibility to appear not only in the Colorado race, but in a number of other states that have attempted to bar him from their primary and general election ballots, including Illinois and Maine. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. The Supreme Court says it will release one or more opinions on Monday, 4th of March, a day before the Super Tuesday primaries, in an announcement widely expected to resolve a dispute over states' ability to remove former President Donald Trump from the ballot under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court had not previously been scheduled for a public sitting, when traditionally decisions in cases argued during the term would be read aloud and handed down. The justices will not take the bench, according to the High Court's website. Opinions released on Monday, 4th of March, will be done electronically. Last month, the justices heard expedited oral arguments in Donald Trump's appeal of a Colorado State Supreme Court decision that would ban the former president from the 2024 ballot for his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. A majority of the justices at the time appeared highly skeptical that an individual state has the authority to deny a candidate for federal office from the ballot as an insurrectionist, as Colorado did. A decision in Trump versus Anderson would come one day before Colorado voters head to the polls. While Donald Trump's name is already on the ballot there, the ruling could determine whether votes for Donald Trump could be counted and would bring clarity to the High Court's view on a 150-year-old constitutional provision and attempts to enforce it against Trump nationwide. Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The U.S. Supreme Court hinted it might rule on Monday, 4th of March, on efforts to bar Donald Trump from the presidential election ballot in Colorado, adding a new opinion day to its calendar, just as voters prepare to head to the polls in Colorado on Super Tuesday. The court never says in advance which opinions it will issue on particular days, but it has handled the Colorado ballot case on an expedited basis, and a ruling on Monday, 4th of March, would provide clarity about Trump's eligibility before Colorado's Super Tuesday Republican primary. The announcement of a new opinion day over a weekend is unusual, all the more so because the justices aren't taking the bench on Monday, as they normally do for rulings. The Supreme Court revealed the new opinion day on its website. The Colorado Supreme Court ruled that Donald Trump was ineligible to appear on the ballot because of his role in the 6th of January 2021 riot at the Capitol. The ruling was the first to bar Donald Trump from the ballot under the Insurrection Clause of the Constitution's 14th Amendment. The Colorado court put its ruling on hold, meaning Donald Trump could appear on primary ballots, while the Supreme Court considers the issue. A state official in Maine and a judge in Illinois have also declared Trump ineligible to appear on the primary ballot, though those decisions are also on hold. Arguments in February suggested that the Supreme Court would let Donald Trump appear on the ballot. The Colorado ballot case is one of more than 30 that have been argued but not yet decided in the Supreme Court's current term.
Yani?
Bazaar.
Bazaar.
Wherever you go, you are surrounded by real estate, whether they are houses, offices, shops, hotels, or education, or even healthcare facilities. These buildings are all the products of Realty Development. Property is a multi-business. It can involve buying land and building on it, renovating or improving, or converting property from one use to another. All of which adds higher value to the area. Property developers quite literally build the world around us, creating and changing the environments we inhabit and use on our daily basis.
Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, industries and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will take a look at Iran's housing and light construction industry. We want to uncover how this market is doing and what contributions it is making to living standards along with the economy. Time to light up today's Bazaar.
In order to become more familiar with the activities of light construction in Iran, we decided to visit a real estate developer in the capital city, Tehran. Nexa Group was established over a decade ago and is a known name in the construction industry. Essentially, it develops luxury properties for residential purposes. In a nutshell, a developer adds value to land or property. What sets this company apart from other developers is its choice of cream-of-the-crop architects who are highly creative, innovative, and experienced in the field of design. Clients who have land they wish to develop can seek the services of this contractor. This company then enters a contract with the owner and begins the process of vetting architects for designing its buildings. In recent years, several competitions have been held by this developer for residential projects. The winning design that meets the high standards of this company and its clients is awarded the project. But that's not all. This company also has a vast network of highly specialized subcontractors to take care of other aspects of construction, such as structure engineering, excavators, and so on. Among its many activities, this developer provides building management services. Such services include maintenance of plumbing, electrical, and mechanical installations of the building.
There are several different types of property development. Some are large scale, meaning that several lots of land are being developed into a single plot. These types of developments can be subdivided and sold individually or as a whole. There are also developments for commercial and sports uses, such as shopping centers and stadiums. Ooh, I like the sound of this.
Projects at this company range from low to medium density residential buildings. This developer also pays particular attention to designing buildings that are environmentally friendly. Most of its buildings are constructed following green practices that also elevate the living standards and quality of experience of its end users. One of its most recent residential projects is called Phoenix. What is most unique about this building is that it was designed based on the traditional 9-square method of Iranian architecture. This green building incorporates the needs of people during the coronavirus pandemic, which includes spaces for working from home. Large investments are made in real estate development each day. But adding value to the property, such as luxury structures with numerous amenities, are what really drive profits. And this company is ready to work with foreign investors and export its services along these lines. One of the competitive advantages of this developer, relative to others in the country, are its innovative and exceptional designs that gain the attention of clients and customers. Its luxury developments are geared to entice customers with more accommodations, higher-end options that integrate an entire lifestyle, and an elevated culture of living. The quality of its work has increased competition in the domestic market, making its buildings a must-have among customers. This property developer also has a unique view of the US-imposed sanctions, which has helped the company thrive throughout the years.
Iran has a growing population of around 85 million people, and the majority of the population is still young. But as time goes by, this population will age as they start families. With this in mind, many of them are embarking on the journey of purchasing homes. And for this to become possible, more housing units need to be constructed to meet this growing need.
The Ministry of Roads and Urban Development estimates that the per capita of housing for each Iranian is around 200 square meters. This means that 17 billion square meters of buildable land is needed to house every Iranian. According to the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development, the annual demand for homes stands at 900,000 units. In more general terms, according to the Ministry of Housing, some 10 million units are currently needed. This is while the average annual production volume for homes is around 300,000 units. So around 1 million residential units need to be built each year to satisfy this demand. Figures from the Statistics Center of Iran show construction of housing increased by nearly 40% last year. Data from the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development show municipalities issue an average of 350,000 residential construction permits each year. Of this amount, roughly 70% lead to construction. However, experts say this is not nearly enough to meet annual housing demands. Last year, the housing construction market saw a slump in completing projects. This was mainly due to the jump in land prices and construction materials that deepened the housing recession. The Ministry of Roads and Urban Development says housing prices have increased by 200% over the last 5 years. This has increased the purchase parity, making some vulnerable groups unable to buy a home.
It might be interesting to know that this issue has gathered the attention of the government for some time now. The government has implemented initiatives to help people purchase homes. One of these initiatives was to increase the amount of bank loans for first home buyers. Several other plans are also underway, such as the vacant house tax plan, to increase the amount of available homes.
President Ibrahim Raisi has pledged to build 1 million residential units each year for the next 4 years. This scheme was presented to address and prevent a housing shortage in the country. The Building Contractors Association says planning, execution, and building material is available. It emphasized that with large investments and land allocation, this plan can easily go forward. But authorities contend that infrastructure such as electricity and water connectivity requires more planning. Government officials also say wrinkles in the financial model for this project still need to be ironed out. Iran is entirely self-sufficient when it comes to construction material, according to the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. Steel, glass, and cement is produced in abundance in the country. In fact, the surplus of these items are exported to several countries around the world. Meanwhile, the light construction industry in Iran is booming amid a long housing recession. New spaces and innovative designs that incorporate the needs of people are being built. Homes are not just a place to live, they are increasingly being seen as a source of capital and a place to increase the quality of living standards. There is also a growing trend towards designing sustainable buildings that reduce emissions and negative environmental impacts. All these achievements make this industry a promising one with a bright future. It is said nearly 70% of the world's protein comes from animal sources. While the plant-based trend is popular for the time being, meat is here to stay. Protein is also a brain food, vital for neurological and other bodily functions. Moreover, globally, the relationship between humans and livestock is fascinating. It has transcended time and space. Yet, despite all the world's technological and scientific accomplishments, mankind has failed to replicate livestock's exact contributions to food, clothing, and even energy. Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation.